JLI is a space which allows you to explore your ideas about what should nurture life, what should be sustainable. I like the fact that it's taken the global agenda for sustainable development as something that we should begin to unpack from a religious space.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Okay. Good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm delighted to be today's guest. And actually, before I ask her to introduce herself, I should tell that this particular episode, again, has a special focus on an organization called JLI, the Joint Learning Initiative on Faith and Local Communities, who works on the nexus of religion and development. And I'm really delighted with today's guest. Whose name is Mary. Mary, please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Maurice. I'm Mary Zulu Muiche. I live in Zambia. Mm-hmm. I'm a clergy. I serve as a pastor in the United Church of Zambia. I'm also a theological educator, serving currently at the church's theological school, which we call the United Church of Zambia. I'm married with two boys and several girls. Mm-hmm. I'm also a grandmother.
Wow.
And
And your children, which age range are they?
The youngest is 14. Okay. The oldest is 34.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Nice.
And so outside my usual work mm-hmm. as a pastor or a clergy, I serve in the community. Mm-hmm. I serve especially with Speak One Voice, an organization that was initiated in the church concerning the issue of gender-based violence and how the church is silent about it. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Speak One Voice as an initiative of women felt that it's important that we begin to raise awareness, to engage in conversations in the church spaces on how the church can be responding to gender-based violence, particularly violence against women and children. Yeah, okay.
Before we go there, Mary, what I would like to ask you is, How did it come about that you became a clergy?
It's once being a Christian or mm-hmm. accepting faith as important to meaning making for myself. I really had a passion to see some kind of order in our society. I think I've always been passionate about issues of justice and what it means to live right, mm-hmm. even before I was a Christian. I think being a Christian just enlightened my understanding about what our responsibilities, our roles are. And that led me to start studying theology. Mm-hmm. So I started studying theology, not because I wanted to be a clergy as in ordained ministry, no. It was just something that I felt would help me to understand better my religion and mm-hmm. how I can engage with it. So in the process, okay. I was encouraged to join the ordained ministries.
Okay, and then you decided not to be a regular clergy, but also be involved in a lot of social justice related issues, and you just started to talk about it, right? So how did you get involved in the One Voice, right?
Speak One Voice. I became involved in social justice issues, I think soon after I became a Christian. I was involved with an organization, a youth organization called World Student Christian Federation. And there I was exposed through leadership training capacities into understanding what liberation theology is all about. And I think that has motivated me to be engaged, to be involved in however little way into issues of community justice issues. So that's my background. Most of my being, my understanding of the role of religion in improving welfare, livelihoods, I think has come mostly from theological engagements. And from there, I think my personal upbringing, my personal upbringing has contributed to wanting to see a more just society, and especially in families. We live in a country where, in terms of things that negate life, disease, poverty, political turmoils, you know, these things shape our understanding of who we are. So when you live in an environment where you constantly reminded, oh, you are a poor country, or you come from a poor country, I think my faith began to question, what does it mean to be poor? Who defines who is poor? What does it mean to be vulnerable? And vulnerability, yes, it's there for most of my context, but my faith challenged me to begin to engage with people in the local setting, to begin to understand from a faith perspective, what is it that we have as resources that can actually help us to improve our livelihoods. So in this journey of trying to balance faith and action, I studied theology. I got involved in orphan work, particularly with the first, it was the government department, social welfare, that looks after orphans and vulnerable children. I would volunteer my time to go and just speak to these young boys, young girls, that some of them had just run away from home because of social economic conditions. And from there, I think colleagues and friends began to identify my passion. They would invite me in leadership capacities to either initiate work around care of overseas or work around church and development. So along the way, the last 20 years of my life or so has been around church and development.
Mary, when I hear you, heard you talk about, you know, why you decided to go to follow this path had to do with your upbringing. So you described, you know, the situation around you. What I wanted to ask you is, were your parents also clergy or your caretakers? Or was it something that, you know, ultimately you figured out, you know, by yourself?
I would say something that I figured out by myself. My parents were non-clergy. My father was even non-committal in terms of Christian faith until much later in his age. My mother was the one who was very committed to her Protestant faith, and she did try to expose us, to lead us to understand what faith means and what it means to live as a Christian. So in those circumstances, my mother, I could safely say, was a Christian for a long time of her life. My father was non-Christian, and he only came to the faith almost maybe 5 years before passing on.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived a life where I could say it was a dysfunctional family in a way, where my mother was mostly alone. My father was wherever. I mean, could hear stories of, which were really not nice for a kid to hear, because you have this ideal of a mother and a father and a family, how it's supposed to live. But yeah, my father most of the time was an absentee person. And we lived, my father and mom, between them, had 6 children. But we lived in a 4-roomed house, Maurice.
Mm-hmm.
6 children plus extended members of the family, most of whom were my father's relatives. So my growing up, the average number that we were in that 4-roomed house would about 14, 15, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was shared spaces. We ate from one plate of main meals, you know. So we shared blankets. Going to school was really hard. In fact, I lived in a community where most of the girls dropped out because of the hardships surrounding our growing up. And it was most girls actually fell pregnant and fell out of school.
Yeah.
But I purposed, I said, no, this is not my life. I need to get out of this space. So I worked hard at school, despite the difficulties and the challenges, so that I could get out of that space. Maybe that's where I get this sense of, wanting to better society, not just for myself, but for other people as well.
And Mary, if I may ask, your brothers and sisters, did they go into a similar direction or?
From my family of six, I'm the only one. I finished school. It was two girls and four boys. I was the second eldest. So I could say that at that time, I was the only one who finished school. And when I moved out of that space, like went to college, started work, I got my younger siblings, three of them, the three boys, and started living with them, hoping that I could give them also an opportunity to get an education and fend for themselves. But it wasn't easy for them. I mean, it wasn't easy for them at all. Two of them finished school, but they didn't do very well. So it's a life where you begin looking after other people at a very young age. Maybe that's how we live in Africa, where as you grow up, you're expected to look after your siblings. The one who is better off takes on the challenge of making sure that you reach out to other family members and help to boost either their education or whatever would help them to be self-sustaining. So I was a mother and father at a very young age, long before I got married.
And is that also how you raise your own children, or are you doing it differently?
I would say I've done it differently. I've tried to give my children their space, where I have conflict as what do I provide for my children? What do I provide for my extended family? Because they are also family. I think I've tried to create spaces for my children where they could receive an education without being disturbed with what's happening at home. And I think it has helped them, because I've seen them grow in their education capacities, in their faith understanding, and they seem to be rooted in understanding who they are as Christians or faith people, and their responsibilities. They are almost all grown now, almost all independent.
Yeah,
we just have one who is still like in secondary school and another one with special needs. One of my nieces, yes. So the feedback I get from them sometimes is that it hasn't been easy. They wished it was different, but yeah, they also acknowledge that I think as a parent, we've tried to give them a better life than the ones that I had.
And if they talk about they wish it would have been different, what are they pointing at or alluding to?
Our economies are maybe average. Let me not use the word poor. Average. Yeah. So we live around, our survival is around meeting basic needs. So things like holidays, you go out for family holidays, family time, you know, are things maybe that they feel they lacked in growing up because they had to share resources with other people. So they think, mommy, if you had saved that money, maybe we could have gone for a holiday together as a family, you know, that kind of thing. And you tell them, ish, my friends, I'm an African woman. Between taking you to a holiday and reaching out to somebody's need, I think I would rather reach out to somebody's need. So get an education, then you take yourselves for a holiday wherever you want. That has been my defense.
And did any of your children, you know, step in your footsteps? You know, are they becoming one of them or more, becoming a clergy?
They actually struggle. They struggle with it because ministry in our context is different. Like I serve in a church which has a missionary background. So what they give as personal emoluments is nothing to talk home about. You actually are cared for by the congregants. And so it depends on the ability of the congregants to take care of you. So you, yeah. So in that sense, they feel that, okay, like the boys, even the girls would actually say, mommy, we see so much capacity in you. I think you can move on. You can go somewhere else. You can join these big international organizations. But I said, no. I feel that for me to be effective in helping people, I need to be in the church space. It may not be the best paying job, but it gives us a sense of satisfaction to see other people being helped. And also there is a sense of security. They may not pay you well, but they'll give you housing. So I'm not paying rent. The church has provided a house in that sense. So for me, it balances up.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, thanks for sharing that, Mary. You know, this, what I try to do in this particular series with the focus on JLI is to meet with JLI staff and partners. I mean, you have been somebody that, you know, belongs to as I call it, the JLI family. Do you still remember the first time that you heard about JLI?
First time I heard about JLI should be around 2019. Through Kirsten.
Okay.
Yes.
Kirsten Lorsten was the former CEO and president of JLI.
Yes.
Until mid 2023. Yeah.
So around 2019, because prior to that, what we have, my latest involvement in gender justice from a church perspective was actually influenced by Kirsten and her team. The Anglican Church in Zambia raised this concern, and they were looking for somebody who could really interpret the design of a toolkit that Kirsten and I think it should be Jane had worked on, that they thought could help churches engage in issues of GBV.
Mm-hmm. So gender-based finance, church, yeah.
Yes. So when the church was looking for that kind of person, I don't know who mentioned my name, and that's how I was given that toolkit to look at and to see if it could work out in our context here.
Yeah. So well, there's been quite a while now.
Yes.
So, what do you like about the work of JLI?
JLI is a space which is inclusive. JLI is a space which allows you to explore your ideas, ideas about what should nurture life, what should be sustainable. I like the fact that it's taken the global agenda for sustainable development as something that we should begin to unpack from a religious space. And so JLI, when like Kirsten mentioned it to my colleagues, if you've noticed, I mean, it's something that they're not even involved with. But when I looked at it and said, wow, religion and development, this is interesting. My master's in theology focused on religion, theology and development.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so I so was
that
able
was a good fit.
To,
yeah.
Exactly. So the JLI resonated with the studies that I'd already undertaken. And yeah, when I looked at what it was doing, I felt, let me explore this space and engage with it. That's how I found myself in JLI.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks for sharing. You know, so JLI is struggling at the moment. There are a lot of several financial challenges. And, you know, one of the things we hope that will help if we are clear, you know, if we are clearer in explaining what JLI is about and why, you know, it needs to be supported and why it needs to be giving the space to continue its work. We have discussions about what, you know, they call in the States the elevator speech. So, you know, you are in for a short period of time with somebody in the space and, you know, you have maybe a minute or 2 minutes to explain what JLI is about. What would you say to, you know, to tell about JLI and to ensure that, you know, when you leave that person, that the person would say, hey, I would like to provide some funding or some support for this organization, but because they are doing great work. What would you say in that 1 minute or 2 minutes?
Religion matters. Religion is an important, ignored asset that development has not considered in its quest to attain sustainability. Religion has a lot of intangible resources which cannot be quantified from a scientific perspective. But when you look at, for example, those of us that are practitioners in the local communities of championing faith, it's amazing how people that you consider to be poor, people that could be considered to be sick, when they are gathered around faith resources, it's amazing how they're able just to resonate that kind of life where hope is sustained, where people are loving, people are exercising their faith despite the challenges that they're passing through. So religion has a lot to offer to the development agenda, especially the intangible resources that are within religion that are often ignored or just not considered to be a part of the what makes life to be.
Mm.
So if someone had to, actually I was thinking, Maurice, about sin and structural, sin as a structural evil, or evil sin as being structural, and we're looking at sustainable development. So if sustainable development has to be achieved, I think we need to consider the structural evil, for lack of a better word, that is in the world. Faith would call it evil. Okay, the world, in the quest to be inclusive, would say, no, we might offend some people if we use that term, but the reality of life is that there is good and evil. So much as we are able to name the good, faith gives you the courage to name the evil for what it is. And so you're able to deal with it because faith gives you those resources to be able to deal with that evil. So I think that's where other development advocates may be missing it, taking good and evil and just putting it in one basket and we are saying it will work. Faith says no. Faith says good is good, evil is evil, and we can take the good and build on it while letting evil simmer, because good is supposed to be the champion over what evil is. So it's a complex thing, but it's worth putting one's resources into.
Mm. And what do you think then that the role of JLI is within this?
Okay, JLI's role is that space that it gives for faith practitioners,
mm-hmm.
Faith researchers, advocates, to be able to explore these resources, to be able to quantify them, if we can quantify them, even if it's quantifying in a qualitative way, to show that, look, we have models of faith working to improve lives, faith working to transform communities. And JLI gives that space to show that evidence that these things are there. Because I agree with the findings in the State of Evidence report of JLI, that usually development agencies will just think, religion, no. Religion is taken to be very fundamental and often brings conflict. And because of that, people tend to shy away from it. But there's a lot of good in religion that can be explored. And that's what JLI is doing, that can be explored and leveraged for the betterment of society.
Let us piggyback a little bit further on, mm-hmm. Because you talked about the report, the State of the Evidence, which is considered to be really the flagship of the work of JLI. You talked about, because what I'm curious about, and I also think a lot of the listeners, is on the one hand, I heard you say, religion, it's difficult from a scientific point of view. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there is the State of the Evidence. And when most people hear the term, evidence, they think about, science.
Yes.
Yeah, can you elaborate a bit on that, on what the State of the Evidence report is aiming to do from your point of view?
The State of Evidence report is aiming to prove a theory, that religion has a lot of evidence which is not documented. And so we do need to document this evidence of success stories, mm-hmm. of faith transforming communities, faith transforming lives. Mm-hmm. The evidence that JLI is trying to produce is evidence that I can say, the word that comes to mind is evidence from the margins, because JLI is not just involved with researchers, okay? You publish and you get known as a professor and whatever. No. JLI is interested in the theologian who is in the margin, in the community. They may not even be, they don't even understand themselves as a theologian, but because they're a faith person, they're able to understand that their faith has resources that they are using in that local community. And for that, JLI provides an opportunity to local communities, actually, to engage with researchers at that level. Okay, someone who may not think of themselves as a researcher, but when they engage, for example, in the community dialogues that we, the listening dialogues that JLI is using as an approach, it's amazing how someone would say, oh, wow, I never thought of myself as a researcher. I never thought of myself as a part of the people that are transforming community. Because I think the greatest asset that faith has, or even the world has, it's the human resource. So JLI brings both the voice of the person that is in, that is living the evidence that we are seeking, as well as now bringing those with the tools and experiences of making this evidence be shown, be real to the world that yes, there is this relationship between faith and development. That's what, for me, JLI mm-hmm. represents.
And no, thanks for that, Mary. And if I ask you to share, maybe a testimony or a transformational story that either you have seen or experienced or have heard of, what would you share?
Let me share from the point of JLI giving us a challenge through Speak One Voice to look at the state of evidence and how that state of evidence resonates with our context here in Africa. Because the state of evidence, I think, was written in other contexts. The evidence mm-hmm. came from other contexts, even if they were authors from the southern part of Africa. Mm-hmm. So we engaged with the evidence, and particularly took the gender-based violence chapter, because that's our interest, yeah. and brought together researchers, practitioners, and just ordinary community members. I think it was a group of about 17 people from yeah. Malawi and Zambia, and engaged with the evidence that was gathered around religion and gender. And it was amazing. The people that were in that conversation, most of them, for example, who are researchers and practitioners, when you talk about gender in our context, you are frowned upon because people think gender is just about women's rights, mm-hmm. Women championing their freedoms. And these women, what is it now that they want us to do? And mm-hmm. But gender is more than just championing women's rights or women's freedoms. So when we gathered around the conversation on gender, religion, and development, what that group came up with in terms of understanding was that, wow, the major problem that might even be hindering our attainment of sustainable development from a gender perspective is the way that Africa, and particularly Malawi and Zambians, are highly religious And because we are highly religious, there's been a group of people that have risen as religious leaders, what we call the charismatic wing of ministry, who in their practice of ministry, we actually find that they're conducting a lot of abuses, especially against women and girls in the name of religion. So we call it the theology of papas, okay? And you discover that in that conversation, when we're saying, what does gender mean in our context? Yes, it's about roles of men and women, but in the context of violence, there's actually a lot of violence that is taking place in the name of religion, because these independent men and some women, but mostly men, have started these churches which are not accountable to anybody. And they have these theories of faith which offer fast solutions. You receive your healing, you receive your children. If you are barren, you're going to be having children, you're going to get rich quickly. And for people who are poor, who are looking for money, who are diseased, who are looking for hope for a better life, when they hear such messages, they flock there. They flock there in masses, and they give even the little that they have to these papas. So you find that in that space, in engaging with this state of evidence, the team that met in Malawi took it upon themselves to say, no, this is something that we need to challenge. We are faith leaders as we are gathered here, but we are not doing enough. So from there, we agreed to form a sub-region where we can carry out these dialogues. And we've continued to carry out these dialogues. And because most of us were coming from academic spaces and church spaces, we've actually engaged our churches in these conversations. And we are seeing some acceptance that, yes, there's a lot more that the church needs to do, or religious institutions need to do, in order to bring out what would end violence against women and girls in our context from a religious perspective. So that is, for me, that has given us hope in terms of where we are going. Hope in the sense that the people that met in this dialogue are not, in Africa, power is also very important. Eh? So we are not big people, but our voices, when we begin to dialogue using the facilitation skills that come with it, is bringing out amazing results in terms of collaboration, in terms of need for networking, and in terms of need even to rethink our theology, to rethink our faith in terms of what it means to live in transformed communities. Okay. Whether it's issues around ecology, issues around children, those are things that are impacting on us in a very negative way. And the state of evidence, I think, gives that that background with which to engage with these issues at a local level and come up with solutions that can help.
Okay. No, that's really helpful, and thank you for sharing your experience. And you know, what I hope that this podcast will do is, JLI, we provide the listeners with different angles of what JLI is about. One question that I personally have a lot of fun always asking, because music is very important to me, is a question in relation to music. So the question that I have for you is, if I ask you to come up with a song or a piece of music that, according to you, represents JLI, or at least for a big part, which song or piece of music would you pick? and why?
I looked at that question and I really, I thought about it and it's kind of hard. I'm not really a musical person, as in listening to music most of the time. But the song that would come to mind, the piece of music that would come to mind is, I don't even know the name of the author, who talks about the love of the father. I'll look it up and send it to you, Maurice.
Okay.
The father's love, and how that yearning of a father's love, once it envelops you, and like God's love is ultimate. It's there, it's available. It's for everyone to just embrace. And when God embraces you as a child, God's love does not violate. God's love does not discriminate. God's love does not, it does not seek to see you end up in a bad way. God's love is actually life affirming. And JLI, I think, has that embracing spirit. If we had to redefine love, what is love? JLI shows love in amazing ways. I'm coming from a so-called developing country, a third world country, all these negative words about development. When I came and participated in the board meeting in Turkey, I just felt loved. I felt accepted. I didn't think I had anything to contribute, but it was amazing how the board members, you know, would just turn out, Mary, what you think? You know, I even had to nudge Dion. Dion, I'm not a board member here. No, would love to hear what you're thinking about this. So that kind of acceptance comes from a place of love. And JLI embodies that love for everyone. It doesn't matter where you come from, so long as you wish to express what you think would help humanity, JLI gives you that kind of space. So that embracing love, that father's love, that we so much yearn for, especially here in Africa, because I don't think I'm the only child that has grown up with an absentee father. Most children in Africa, in Zambia, I grew up with an absentee father. And you are yearning all the time that I wish my father was here. I wish my father could do this. And JLI gives that opportunity to express yourself and feel loved and not condemned in the process, even as you are expressing yourself. So okay. I love JLI for that.
Now you make me really curious about which song you have picked. So if you remember during our conversation, please let me know.
Okay.
And if you remember only after the recording is done, I will make sure we share it in the podcast notes. Mary, if I ask you to name one colleague, a partner, or a supporter of JLI who best embodies what JLI is about, and we heard you explain in different ways what JLI is about, who will you name and why?
Olivia.
Olivia Wilkinson?
Olivia, yeah. Yes. I don't know Olivia in person. I deal mostly with Sadia.
Mm-hmm.
Sadia is a gentle, loving person. Olivia is quiet in the background, but I love the way she is so focused on what JLI is and what JLI needs to accomplish and where JLI is going. Olivia, to me, seems to hold the vision of JLI in a balanced way. As a researcher, as a mentor, she may not know it, but I think she does mentor in the way that she just approaches, for example, how she approaches us through Sadia as a region, as we are trying to nurture ourselves as a hub. So Olivia, for me, somehow mentors me in the background.
Mm. Okay.
Yes.
No, thank you. And just for to remind the listeners, and I don't know if you are aware, we did episodes already, both with Sadia as well as with Olivia. So you can check those podcast episodes out as well to hear from them firsthand. Mary, you talked in the beginning about the Sustainable Development Goals. So I agree with you, they are important because, you know, they might not be perfect, but they give us some guidance on where we should take this world to make it more sustainable, more just. But unfortunately, you know, we are at the midpoint, and on average, the Sustainable Development Goals, we've reached only 15% or something. So it seems mm-hmm. that JLI's mission is more crucial than ever, mm-hmm. and especially around joint learning. So what do you think is the power of joint learning, and how do you see the potential of collaborative approaches in creating sustainable change?
Mm-hmm. The power of joint learning is that we do need to rethink our understanding of what it means to learn. Again, I'm coming from a context where our education system is tainted in colonialism. So even the kind of learning that is there is what I would call still rote memory, knowledge that is prescribed by other people for, you know, so you're getting some education or some form of learning that prepares you either to speak good English or to know that you've actually completed school, you've completed university, but there are no jobs. There are no jobs. And that is a major problem that most African countries have, that we have this educated cadre of people that actually have no jobs to go to. That's where joint learning comes in as an alternative to understanding what does it mean to learn. It's joint learning for me represents how knowledge is not just a preserve of educational, formal educational institutions. Joint learning opens you to the idea that knowledge is actually out there in the community, even in the villages, because we have villages back here where we think they've got nothing to offer. For example, that I would give in the significance of joint learning is how we'd be talking about culture, for example, at an academic level, and we'd define culture, we'd see the advantages and disadvantages of culture and everything. And yet, Maurice, in my context, when it comes to issues of culture in the family, it is still mm-hmm. deeply entrenched. It doesn't matter how educated you are, especially in relation to roles of men and women. Culture will still come in, despite that you have received all this formal education about how you know, knowledge opens you up to all this and everything. So for an African, for me as an African, much as formal education is important, my cultural background informs who I am, what I become in society. No matter the degrees that I get, I'll still be somebody's wife. I'll still be expected to perform in a certain way from a cultural perspective because I'm a woman. Even when I go to the workplace, it's almost a struggle to attain even the highest position of leadership in a workspace because culture has preserved that for men. So patriarchy is real. Mm. It's real in our context, and it shows how at an academic level, you are struggling with these things. But in the community, at community level, at family level, this is exactly what we are living. In our culture in Zambia, we have a tradition where, for example, when you're getting married, a female that is getting married is expected to go through certain rituals and cultural teachings and everything. And again, like I said, it's amazing how this girl would have gone to school in the UK, in America, but because they're marrying a Zambian or a Malawian, she's expected to go through these traditional rituals and teachings and everything, because that's what our culture teaches us that marriage is all about. So there's always that conflict of what is valid knowledge. So despite that, we have these formal education systems, our culture still tags us behind, our tradition still tags us behind, and it has a very negative impact on how we live. So joint learning gives us an opportunity to be able to look at, this is the formal thing, but this is the practice. Okay, so the researcher, the practitioner, come together and share knowledge and begin to see where the gaps are and begin to see which we can leverage for better livelihoods.
So if you considering what you just shared and looking at your own children, and at your grandchildren, what do you hope, will happen for them?
Wow. Tried to raise them in the, I'd call it Western culture, because our education system is clothed with Western culture. But at some point, especially when they become teenagers going onwards, we begin talking about what it means to be a Zambian and the identity of a Zambian. We also begin to talk about the Christian identity, the faith. All things, I think faith should define who we are, whether Zambian with an educated, with a Western influence. I think the faith resources should balance me up to be both. So that's what I strive for my children. It hasn't been easy. They still choose their own pathway for life, but we always try to remind them that yes, you can go to some of the best schools in this country, but remember who you are. You're a Zambian. Remember that you are a Christian, and we pray that you hold on to your faith, because that's what will help you to overcome the challenges of life.
Mary, JLI consists of a community of faith-based and secular actors. So it's, it's really an interesting bunch of people together, right? What is the value of these kind of partnerships? And I've heard my colleagues say, well, but JLI is not another interfaith organization. So how do you see this?
Yeah, JLI is... I cannot say it's a faith organization, but I think I'll describe it as an organization that brings faith entities together. So I don't know if that qualifies it to be a faith organization. It's a space. For me, it's a safe space where to express your faith. Faith, in this case, is anything that someone believes in. It may be religious faith. It may be non-religious faith. It is still faith. And that's a space that JLI provides.
These conversations always go fast. What I want to ask you, though, is... Yeah, what do you hope this podcast might do for JLI, this podcast episode?
That it makes JLI visible to other partners, and it also gives hope or encourages somebody, especially from developing parts of the world, to know that there is a space where you can actually go and express, have dialogue with other colleagues about what it means to develop from a faith perspective. I also hope that because JLI is a family, collaborators, that the family will grow bigger than what it is already.
But is there any question that I did not ask you that I should have asked you?
Maybe something related to the role of JLI in being a learning space. Much as it is a networking and collaboration space, it is also a learning space. A learning space in terms of one wanting to up their research skills, also in terms of community engagement, especially with the listening dialogues, because that gives you time to think through how those questions that are under the listening dialogue, you think through how do these actually reflect in my own context. And I've been privileged to be able to engage with the listening dialogues, I think in 3 or 4 forums now. And the outcome has been very encouraging. With requests, please, can you come back again and we have this conversation? Because usually when we are doing charity work in Africa, it's more welfareism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You receive and you give out to the needy and everything. But JLI gives you that space to think about your needs, mm-hmm. to think about what you're doing, and ask yourself if you are doing it better. So you still have to provide your own answer if I'm doing it better or not. So in terms of asking questions, I think, Maurice, you've asked most of the questions. We've engaged with the state of the evidence, especially mm-hmm. the GPV one, because that's what I am. But when you look, even at the state of evidence report, the issues that it raises, peace and conflict, ecology issues. Right now, we are facing serious droughts in our parts of our country. Mm-hmm. I just heard on news, Nigeria in West Africa, they're beginning to riot because of economic hardships and all. So these are issues that actually affect us.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we did not talk much about the development goals and mm-hmm. why these are important for religion. Religion cannot shy away from engaging with the development goals. Maybe that's the sad reality of my context, that these are things that we don't talk about, even like in the local church setting as clergy. To say, do you know what's happening? These are the development goals and this is what we... And yet faith, Romans 12:1, going to verse 2, talks about transforming our minds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You commit yourself to the Lord and then transform your mind. But that transformation cannot take place mm-hmm. if, as a faith person, you do not understand the realities that are surrounding you.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a challenge that we have. And the sustainable goals are very important. Mm-hmm. They are defining who we are. They are defining our economics. They are defining our politics. But the local people do not understand them. Mm. So how do we bring it down to them?
Yeah. And there, as you said, you know, faith and or faith organizations yeah. can play a very important role. I'm really happy that you raised that. My listeners of the other episodes know that you know, I try to lift up always the sustainable development goals, and sustainable development goals are, you know, trying to focus on systems and process changes that are required. Mm-hmm. But this mm-hmm. growing group of people around the world, you know, they are saying is what we have forgotten is that to put emphasis as well on the knowledge, skills, and abilities as individual as well as community to yes. ensure that we can make those changes mm-hmm. happen. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, faith-based organizations and people of faith mm-hmm. Are very well equipped to work on 5 goals that this growing group of people have identified. They call it the inner development goals that are necessary. And the first goal is being, thinking, relating, collaborating, and acting. So that goes back to empathy, taking care of your neighbors, right? So there are a lot of, if not all, similar values as you know, many, if not all, faith traditions are about, according to me. So thank you for raising that. Yeah, as I said, time goes fast. So I would like to really thank you for your willingness to share your wisdom and you know, share time to share your experience as well. Would like to wish you all the best with all the important work that you do. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Maurice. Thank you for this time. I pray that I made sense.
You did. You did. You absolutely did. As we wrap up today's insightful conversation, I hope it has sparked your curiosity and interest in the vital work of the Joint Learning Initiative on Faith and Local Communities, JLI. If today's episode has resonated with you, whether it's the desire to collaborate, contribute, or even offer financial support to further JLI's impactful mission, we'd love to hear more from you. The JLI's journey is one of collaboration, learning, and making a tangible difference in communities through the unique intersection of faith and development. Your involvement could be a significant part of this transformative process. Whether you're looking to offer your expertise, resources, or are seeking to understand more about how you can contribute, your initiative is invaluable. Please feel free to reach out to us. Send an email to maurice@jlifc.com or contact us through our platform. We welcome your thoughts, questions, and proposals for collaboration. I'll personally ensure that your interest is directed to the right people at JLI, helping you connect with a network of individuals and organizations dedicated to creating a better world through faith-informed development. Thank you for joining us on Walk, Talk, Listen, where each conversation brings us closer to understanding and action. Your engagement doesn't just end with listening, it begins here. Let's continue to be part of this remarkable journey together. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.